Welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast, helping you ace your exams at school and university through the psychology of high performance and the science of studying smarter, not harder. It's my pleasure to introduce your host, the Cambridge-trained memory psychologist and exam success coach, William Wadsworth!
Hello and welcome to the Exam Study Expert Podcast. Today we're continuing our special educator-focused mini-series, which is broadcasting as a special daily sequence throughout this week. Today we're stepping back and taking stock of the rise of evidence-based practice in education, figuring out how far we've come and looking at where we are going to go next. My headline guest today is the founder of the ResearchEd conference series, Tom Bennett OBE, which has been hugely influential here in the UK, as well as many other countries around the world. And I'll also be joined towards the end of the episode today by a couple of other recent guests who are sharing their perspectives on that core question of how far we've come in terms of getting evidence out into education practice, and then how we might develop further in this direction in the future. But first, I'm very excited to introduce to the Exam Study Expert Podcast, Tom Bennett. Tom, a very warm welcome to the show.
So, Tom, welcome.
Hi, nice to see you, William.
It's probably fair to say you're known for a couple of main things, Tom. One is your kind of expertise and leadership in the world of behavior management, and the other is the founding the ResearchEd movement and your kind of contribution to evidence-based practice. I just wanted to ask about the second one a little bit. So for those that aren't aware, in a sentence or two, what is ResearchEd?
ResearchEd is a community of people who want to get together and put together conferences to try to raise the evidence basis and the research literacy of the education community. That's about as succinct as I can put it. It's a non-profit organisation which I started in 2013, and we've been going since then, putting on conferences all around the world, just trying to bring together all the best voices, both in research but also in practice, and try to get them to talk to one another in order to create some kind of wonderful synthesis of ideas and practice, which will help, hopefully help the profession drive itself forward.
Well, I've been to several and I'm a fan. So thank you.
Thank you for coming.
Maybe we could just go back to the beginning. So 2013, 2012, even when you were sort of having the genesis of this idea, just tell us a little bit about what the world was like back then and where the drive to start this came from.
Okay, so I was a teacher back in 2013. I was full-time working in an inner city school in East London, and I'd been doing it for about 10, 13 years. And I loved it. But one of the things I remember finding quite early on was that nobody seemed to kind of know anything. I don't know if that makes sense. That nobody seemed to know anything for certain. If you ask somebody how much homework should a student get, you know, everyone had lots of ideas and opinions, but nobody seemed to know. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
You know, if you ask somebody, does restorative practice work, or, you know, should we set a detention, or, you know, how long should a lesson be, or how should I plan a lesson? You know, what should go into it? Nobody seemed to know. Everybody had an opinion. There was no shortage of opinions. And I remember years ago, I studied philosophy at university, right? Which is why I was unemployable for so many years. But I loved it. I loved it. And one of the things that really animated me there was epistemology, you know, the theory of knowledge, the philosophy of knowledge.
Yeah.
How do we know what we know? And how can we say when we know something? And what does it mean to know something? And so on. Which may sound a wee bit dry and cryptic, but I find it fascinating. Because one of the things that has dragged us as a civilization, as a species, into civilization and out of, you know, animalism is empirical science and the idea that we can learn from the, you know, the inductive method, and we can make hypotheses and test these hypotheses and discount them and make probabilities and stuff. And that's how you end up with mobile phones. Some people may say we've gone back. But the point is, you know, that's how we develop the science and technology that's transformed the world. And yet, when it came to education, it just struck me as being quite striking that we didn't do that. And there was all kind of finger in the wind stuff. And I started to write a blog, I can't remember now, but 2010 or something like that. Back when blogs were new, back when people blogged. Sorry, for younger listeners, a blog is like a diary that you put online and you say what you like. And I wrote a blog about a lot of things, but also about when people made kind of really weird, spurious claims in the media. about the efficacy of various things in education. And so, for example, I mean, one of the things I remember just now is I visited some schools where you weren't allowed to use red pen, right?
Right.
And when I said, well, why aren't you allowed to use red pen? When you were marking, I mean.
Yeah.
And they would say, oh, because it's got negative connotations. You know, it impacts upon students' motivation. And I was kind of like, what? And they said, oh, yeah, red, it's the colour of danger, it's the colour of blood, and students associate it with failure. I remember thinking, well, tell that to Santa Claus. Tell that to Coca-Cola. You know, this, I mean, it sounds, I get the theory of change, you know, the colour of blood, the colour of danger, right? But I remember thinking, but hang on, that's just nonsense. You just made that up, right? And education was full of that. And another one was, I remember reading an article, I don't know if you're even old enough to remember this, William. There was an organisation, a project in America called Troops to Teachers. And it was an attempt to recruit teachers from the armed services. And it was primarily an American thing. But it kind of came over here as well in a very small form, as we do. You know, they get Elvis Presley, we get Cliff Richard. And there was lots of people saying, oh, Troops of Teachers makes brilliant teachers. Why? Because they're used to high discipline environments and so on and so forth. And again, you can understand the theory of change. And incidentally, I'm not against soldiers becoming teachers. I've met some brilliant teachers who used to be in the forces, right? And God bless them and thank them for their service. But the idea that this was somehow kind of a rich seemed to be mined of the best tech teachers. Remember, and so I looked at their evidence bases and I found out that the people that were making these claims were the institutes that ran the program itself.
Right.
So it was all kind of, you know, walking your own homework. And I just used to blog about that and pointing out the kind of the somewhat obvious errors and biases that crept into these somewhat spurious claims that were often made. And then I wrote a book called Teacher Proof, which was, I mean, it's not a brilliant book if I'm honest. And I can be honest. Don't buy it. But it was my attempt to start at least thinking about what it meant to be an evidence-informed teacher. At the same time, there was other bits and pieces happening, very much catalyzed by social media, whereby people were starting to wake up a wee bit to this. You know, there were other people writing in this area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's people like Ben Goldacre, for example, who was famous for his bad science project, you know, his column in The Guardian and his books and so on, but also, you know, more broadly, his advocacy work. And he was writing about this, and he started to write about education. He started to write about the fact that, you know, so much in education just seemed to be made up. And then people like Andrew Old, the blogger, you know, he was also writing about this. So I started to write about it too. And then famously, or infamously, one evening, I was sitting on the sofa watching G.I. Joe, I believe it was. And I was online on Twitter as well. So it couldn't have been that good a film. And Ben Goldacre and Sam Friedman, whom I'd met a couple of times by this point, were talking about the need for more evidence-informed education. And Sam Friedman, who at the time was a special advisor, I think, to Michael Gove, Secretary of State for Education. And he said, oh, you know, we need somebody to put on a conference. I nominate Tom. You know, it was a completely spurious, just, you know, friendly thing to say. And because I'm a bit like Marty from Back to the Future, I can't resist a dare. And I remember saying, yeah, that sounds a great idea. I love evidence-informed education. Let's do it. So I put a tweet out that night because I had quite a big following at that point, you know, which helps you get the message out. And so I put the word out saying, would anyone like to help me put on a conference? You know, it was a classic 11 o'clock at night decision. You know, I should have just watched the film, if I'm honest.
Yeah,
I was up till about 3 o'clock in the morning with people. I mean, people were up, but people were keen. They were dying to do this. I mean, I had hundreds of messages and emails from people saying, we want to speak. We would love to help. We'll stuff bags for you. You know, we'd love to host this. You know, I got school after school after school saying we'd like to do it. We had newspapers contacting us saying, you know, can we come to see this? Can we get The Guardian even offered to host the first research ed, which was nice of them. And Tez and people like that wanted to get involved. And I just remember thinking, holy smoke, what have I done? And I went to school the next day. And then at my break and after school, I went back online. And it was just, you know, hundreds of emails saying, let's do this. So we did it. And it was a sellout and it was brilliant. And it was a very, very much kind of an activist, ground roots based, you know, ground up type thing. So, you know, somebody designed the logo for free. Someone put up a web page for us for free. You know, the school offered to host. And it just all came together. It took a lot of organization. Helen O'Shea, who has been an absolute stalwart and my kind of my comfort and my guide in this, asked if she could get involved. And so Helen and I have been putting, you know, doing the hard miles on this for 10 years now. And if I can just start speeding up slightly, because I know that, you know, you don't have all day. We did one conference and it was an absolute knockout success. We had teachers, we had scientists, we had researchers, academics, You know, we had people involved in budgets. We had policymakers. It was just fantastic. And they were all just talking about evidence-informed education, you know, what it meant to be evidence-informed and what evidence bases there were. And it was such a democratic day because there was, you know, people in policy speaking next to head teachers, speaking next to teachers, speaking next to teaching assistants, next to academics and researchers. They all just wanted to have this conversation. And it was brilliant. And it was the biggest buzz of my life. And I'm so, so proud that we managed to pull it off altogether. And it couldn't have happened without all these people. And then afterwards, I remember a week later, somebody, I think it was... Joe Kirby. He said to me, when's the next one? And I was like, I didn't think we were going to have another one. So we did one. And it was because people wanted it. And then somebody from New York said, we're doing one in New York. So we went to New York and did it. And then we did another 5 and 6. And then we did Australia. And then we did Netherlands. And boom, we're in 16 countries now. We've had hundreds of events over the past 10 years. Some of the events have had 2,000 people coming to them. Some of the smaller ones have 150 people coming to them. But that's kind of where we are now. I often say it's succeeded despite me. And it is still a non-profit. You know, we still just get by in a wing and a prayer. You know, we break even for some events. We lose on some of the events, and some of the events make a surplus that goes into the other events. But, you know, up until even this year, nobody got paid at all for 10 years. So we're quite proud of how we've managed to keep it together, despite the odds. That was a long answer for a short question.
The history deserves it, I think. it's been quite a 10 years. And, you know, I think I came to my first in, I think maybe late 2019 or 2020, it might have been my first. I can't remember.
A late start.
Yeah. I've been to many since, and they're always such wonderful days.
Really, I'm going to turn the table here. What did you like about it? What appealed to you about it?
Well, I came to my first with a very specific objective. So my real interest, as regular listeners will know, is helping students apply the science of learning to their own independent learning, in particular to exam revision.
Yeah.
So interestingly, at exactly the same time the first research ed was happening, Dunlosky and his colleagues published their seminal paper on what kind of strategies work when it comes to effective independent study.
Yeah.
And it struck me that there was such strong evidence for, you know, using this stuff, and not just evidence, you know, by the time I turned up my first researcher, I'd got a lot of kind of on the ground experience of just how like powerful this stuff is when you do it well.
Mm.
And teachers were starting to talk about, you know, we're starting to talk to students about it and get the right messages out. But I was curious about how we were doing. And I wanted to measure how well we were doing as a country in getting that message out to students.
Yeah.
So I was launching something called the Revision Census. So I partnered with Henry Rödinger, I'm sure you know, the sort of founding father of retrieval practice. He'd done the kind of only study I could find trying to measure the uptake of effective study strategy in students, but it was old and small and in a US college. And I wanted to do a new and big one in UK schools. So Andy at Research Ed Ipswich very kindly kind of answered my call and kind of gave me a platform when I could talk a little bit about the kind of science and what I was trying to do and the research. And that kind of got the ball rolling with getting partner schools on board. And we've since surveyed nearly 50,000 students across the country on how they go about their revision.
Amazing. I mean, thank you. Thank you for being so open about that, because I find it quite amazing that something like Research Ed was so successful, that there was such a space for it to exist. I find it amazing that it didn't already exist, if that makes sense. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's been so successful. You know, they often say that when you're trying to develop a product, not that it was ever a product, you know, find out what nobody else is doing, but everybody wants.
Yeah.
Right? And we just kind of stumbled upon this. But I remember just thinking, this is mad. Why aren't people talking about retrieval practice? Why isn't everybody in education completely conversant with the very basic principles of, you know, interleaving and spaced learning and retrieval practice and the testing effect? You know, why isn't this just completely fundamental to the practice of education, which, you know, let's face it, revolves a lot around knowing and remembering stuff.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Perhaps that's controversial. And if somebody like you wanted to do something like what you just described, you know, there's lots of ways of doing it, I guess, but if you wanted to talk about it and promote it and discuss it and get people involved in it, you would have to kind of publish it in an academic journal.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was this big space for us to move into, and it's been a joy to see people like yourself and thousands of other people, organisations, teachers, teaching assistants, heads say, we're doing this project, or we've tried to employ direct instruction in our school. This is what we found, but we're not sure. So, you know, let's just talk about it. It's been such a joy to be part of catalysing that conversation.
Yeah.
I feel like I kind of a proud grandfather in some shape or form.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's been really interesting from my perspective, seeing how things have evolved in the decade since Research Ed was born. And now, you know, I know there's been lots of factors and influences, just about research shed, but they, you know, it's all these things working together to get more evidence-based practice into schools. You know, my own perspective, you know, in my specific little niche interest, which is getting students to revise more effectively, you know, I can see we've been running the revision centers for 4 or 5 years now, and there's a couple of schools that have been with us from the beginning where we can see there's a special category we put students in when we think, basically, with all due respect, you haven't got it. You're not revising effectively yet. Yeah. And in a couple of schools, for the first time in the last time we ran the census earlier this year, we saw that group of students completely eliminated in their exam year, which meant that they basically got no learner left behind. Like, everybody had kind of got into, you know, on some, and there was still a spectrum, like some were doing really, really well and some were doing sort of well, but like they'd kind of completely eliminated that category of students that were revising really, really poorly, you know, just rereading stuff, for example. And then, you know, we know the kind of impact that has on someone's life. We know the impact that has on the grades you come out with, your enjoyment of the process, all of those really, really positive things. As you say, it's just been a really exciting time to, you know, certainly from the little bit of the world that I've been kind of tracking, it's been really exciting to see that progress.
That's really interesting to hear. I remember when I was a teacher, so I was teaching from about 2003 onwards until about 2019, like that, right? And, you know, give an example. So when I got my GCSE classes or my A-level classes, and the school, let's focus on GCSE, and the school would say, right, the exams are coming up, so we want you to start doing some revision classes. And that's it. That would be the instruction. Now, what did that then mean? What did we actually have to do? Well, nobody really knew what to do. So they kind of reinvented the wheel for themselves. So you would announce to your classes that Thursday at 3 o'clock there'd be an after school revision class, or, you know, or whatever. And so, you know, you would get the keen turning up, or maybe the desperate, or maybe the lonely, or people who just wanted to come in from the cold. So you get this kind of very odd mixed bunch of people that some of them really needed to be there, some of whom didn't need to be there at all, and would have been perfectly fine doing it by themselves. And then what do you do when you've got them? And the temptation is, for many teachers, is just to kind of, well, let's just teach the whole course again really, really quickly. And there was no sense whatsoever of strategy or what actually works and what do we need to focus on and how do we know what to focus on and how global do we make it, how specific do we make it, do we mind map? Mind maps were about as far as we got, you know, in terms of complexity.
That was the cutting edge, wasn't it?
I remember, you know, some teachers would, for instance, take the best mind maps of the previous year and give them to their students the next year, you know, thinking, well, this must be a good tool for you.
Yeah.
And it was just a kind of a nobody knows anything scenario. And yet we know so much about memory. We know so much about, you know, Rosenstein's principles and so on, that we know a lot about what needs to be done. And I think what's changed is that a lot of teachers, but not all teachers, may I just say, there's still a huge number of teachers who don't do this. We've got a lot of teachers now who get it right in the first case. You know, they'll use, for instance, Rosenstein's principles to teach something, or they'll adapt that to their own situations and circumstances. And then they will adopt forms of retrieval practice as part of their integrated curriculum. So they know what they're doing. And that's done across every term. So they're basically, they're making the maximum use of their time in the classroom before they get to the exam hall, which then, of course, reduces the need for this kind of short, intense cramming period, which tends to end up just with people reading as much as they can. And as you'll know, of course, for some students, that is actually a relatively effective thing to do. And by effective, I mean it gets them across the line. But that's a minority of students, and it's not what you would call effective learning. And it doesn't help them get to the next stage of their educational careers. You know, it doesn't help them once they're in university just because they've crammed something the night before. And I say that as a crammer. You know, I absolutely nailed every one of my exams at school, not because I'm incredibly clever, but because I crammed like a demon. Oh, and I listened the first time. You know, I often say it to my students, you know what's really good for your education?
Yeah.
Listening the first damn time I tell you and taking notes.
Good tip.
That's what I did. I remember thinking, this is quite easy. And people didn't do that and found it hard. I mean, fancy that.
I'm smiling when you were talking about mind maps.
Love a mind map.
People on the podcast won't be able to see this, but these are my actual mind maps from when I was doing my GCSEs.
My God, the fact that you had that handy to hand, that's incredible.
Thing is, I actually, you know, I was, like you were describing, you know, I was kind of bright enough when I'd listened the first time. I got 10 A stars, which was amazing for my school. But that was really in spite of having terrible study strategy.
I was
quite annoyed when I got to Cambridge, read psychology and learned about retrieval practice. And I was like, crikey, you know, I wanted to know that 5 years ago. Why did no one tell me that 5 years ago? So anyway, that's my origin story in a nutshell.
No, I like that. That's a good supervillain origin story. It's not even that students need to know about retrieval practice. It just needs to be integrated into what they do. I don't mind if students never know what it is. And to be honest, I think it is quite useful when students are aware of the general principles. But what's really important is that they do them, you know, that it becomes a habit for them to do this type of stuff. And yes, I think it's useful if they know why they're doing it and so on. And I think that's an important thing too.
A couple of quick fire questions to see us home, Tom. So if you could put a message on a billboard for teachers everywhere to see bright and bold, what would it say?
Abandon hope, all ye who enter herein. Not at all. I think I would say, you know, it's funny because before this, and listeners, I don't know how aware of this you are, but William was kind enough to ask me if I wanted any questions in advance, and I said no, because I'm essentially quite lazy. But this is one of those questions where I wish I had prepped slightly. I think my response would be, I mean, my big thing is behaviour, right? So I'm going to focus on that for a second, which is that the very first thing every teacher should do is to clearly teach their children the habits they need,
yeah,
the behaviours they need in order to succeed in a classroom. And the reason for that is that a lot of students come into classrooms and they're not sure about, you know, where to sit and what equipment to use and how to respond to a question and what to do when they're stuck and what to do when their pen inevitably breaks and covers their hand in black ink. You know, a lot of students don't know this stuff, and it's really important that we make it clear to them, this is how you succeed in my classroom. So that's the first thing I would say to them. Second thing I would say, trying to make it more evidence-informed, would be that whenever you're asked to do something in education, always retain the right to ask, why are we doing this? Why are we doing this? That simple, that even that one word, why, which is the word that every child uses to drive their parents mad, is a word you can use to drive your line managers mad. Because in education, people will ask you to do all kinds of things, and that's fine, right? Because education is a hierarchy, and institutions are hierarchies. But often you'll be asked to do something on the basis of no evidence whatsoever. And sometimes that's okay too, as long as you know that that's the case. So the school might say something along the lines of, I want to greet all your students when they come into the classroom. And you might say, well, why do you want me to do that? And they might say, because we think it's nice. And that's okay. It's okay to do things for aesthetic or moral reasons. Why are we doing this? It's something that every teacher should be prepared to ask.
Fantastic. Tom, thank you so much for a wonderful conversation. It's been really, really good to meet, really good to chat. Thank you so much. If anyone's curious to learn more about ResearchEd, about your work, about, you know, your kind of resources on behaviour, all that stuff, where would you signpost people to? Where can we go next to find more?
Sure. Well, I mean, if you want, you can look at www.researched.org.uk to find out more about the work that we do and if there are conferences coming to a place near you. If you want to find out more about my general principles of behaviour and theory and particularly practice, I've got a book called Running the Room, which is a bestseller in all charts everywhere, and hopefully you will find it useful. And if you want to find out more, you can also visit my website, which is tombennettraining.co.uk, I think. Type in Tom Bennett Training. There's not many Tom Bennett Trainings out there. And you can find out the more of the work I do with schools. But, you know, always happy to hear from people on social media. Tom Bennett 71. As long as Elon Musk allows us to have rational conversations, I am there to do so. William, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk soon. Well, thanks again, Tom. Absolute pleasure to talk. And thank you again for all your contribution to getting evidence-based practice out into schools. I was really interested to hear a couple of other perspectives on this same theme. So, you know, how far we've come getting evidence-based practice into education, and also, you know, where are we going with it next? What is still left to do? So to round this episode off, I want to hear from two recent guests on this question. We're going to be hearing from Peps McRae and Dr. Hiley Hughes. It's perhaps worth saying that all my guests today, Tom, Peps and Hiley, are closest to the UK school system, as am I, but I'm very conscious we have an international listener base. So if you're feeling hard done by, stay tuned for Sunday's episode, when I'll be talking to John Donlosky, who'll be helping us at least a little bit sort of fill in that American perspective. But you know, my sense from talking to listeners and researchers around the world, as I do, is that the UK is far from unique. You know, most countries are on a pretty comparable journey to what you're hearing described here in today's episode. So to conclude, we're going to be hearing in a moment from Peps McRae with his take on how far we've come and where we're at in the journey to getting evidence-based practice into education. But first, let's hear on that same question from Dr. Hiley Hughes.
I'm so pleased that teachers and schools are taking evidence and research seriously. But I think we need to be careful that actually we're not cherry picking research, because I'm seeing an awful lot of that going on at the moment. And being research and evidence informed doesn't mean having a pre-existing ideology or approach and then searching for evidence that backs up that ideology.
Right.
You know, Dylan William has often spoken about the fact that teachers can never really be a completely evidence informed profession, because actually, you know, we're dealing with human beings here with all sorts of nuances. You know, it's not medicine where we know that we're going to give something to somebody and it's going to have a predictable effect. So I think, you know, schools need to think really heavily about their context and to go for best bets, because that's all we can do. I think, you know, that implementation that we talked about before is really important as well. So I think where schools will go next is that I think they will pay attention to the evidence. We're all becoming more research and evidence informed in education, but I think they will think very carefully about context as well. And I think that's really a positive thing.
I do think it has been a really exciting period in the history of the profession in the last 10 years, I'd say. In particular, 15 years ago, there were very, very few schools, very few teachers who were employing evidence-informed approaches, evidence-informed strategies routinely within their classes. I was a teacher then, and I was doing all sorts of crazy stuff. I was using BrainZoom because somebody had told me that that was an effective strategy. I was catering to what I perceived were people learning styles. And we know now that both of those things are a myth and potentially actually, you know, damaging for learners. I'm pretty confident that in England, at least, there is going to be a lot fewer teachers using strategies like that, and a lot more teachers leaning on strategies that have some form of evidence base, such as retrieval practice, some of the implications from cognitive load, even ideas from the kind of more social and emotional side of the evidence around belonging and motivation. And so, yes, I think we have come a long way in 10 years. I find it really encouraging and heartening, because the more our practice is grounded in evidence, the more chance that it helps our students to learn stuff and develop agency and be able to go out and live great lives. However, there's still a hugely long way to go before we can begin to rest on our laurels, if we ever get to that point. And I think a useful contrast is the field of medicine. In medicine, they have a really strong research pipeline, just constantly really high quality, relevant evidence coming through the door that they're able to grapple with. There is sufficient funding that allows doctors to be able to study for many, many years and continue to study throughout their professional lives. And they have, like, the NHS has a huge amount of support from the public at large, which enables that kind of funding and status that comes with it. Now, we don't have those things in place quite yet. However, I think that will be the next 10 years. If you come back to me in 2033, William, I'd like to hope that we've made some progress in some of those aspects. And together, those things hopefully will allow us to take another step towards being an even more effective profession.
And if you want to increase the amount of evidence in your life, as I've mentioned on the podcast in his own episode with us just a couple of episodes ago, I highly recommend Peps's Evidence Snacks weekly email, a bite size of evidence goodness for evidence hungry teachers. You can find that on Peps's website. Just Google Peps McRae and click on Snacks at the top. Really wonderful email to get in your inbox each week. So we've obviously been celebrating Research Ed quite heavily in this episode. I also just wanted to acknowledge before we close that there have been many, many other educators and academics working incredibly hard and doing wonderful things in service of this same goal. And I really don't kind of want to single out particular people or initiatives in this, with one exception, and that's the Learning Scientists Project. And I feel quite comfortable singling them out just because they've had such a profound influence on my own life. And one of the reasons I started this podcast was their own podcast inspired me. And they are still one of the names that come up over and over again when I go into schools and have conversations about the science of learning. So I hope you've enjoyed today's show. And if you've recently discovered us, this week's special series for educators is a little bit different to our normal output. But if you're enjoying the episodes this week, then there's an extremely good chance you'll enjoy what we normally cover on the show, because we're absolutely passionate about taking an evidence-based approach, in particular to how we learn effectively, equipping learners with the best learning strategies and study habits based on the science of mindset and cognitive psychology and how memory works and all that good stuff. You can check out our extensive archive of past episodes. Maybe, for example, you might be interested in checking out Pep's recent primer on memory, episode 149, or you could catch Learning Scientist co-founder Dr. Jana Weinstein back in episode 45 when she was talking us through the six pillar strategy of effective learning that the learning scientists talk about. We make our week-to-week content lovingly aimed at helping learners themselves study smarter, but I know many, many educators around the world tune in too to pick up tips and tricks to pass on to their students. So please do feel right at home, subscribe, follow the show, and take advantage of all we have to offer. You might even like to recommend us to your students as a resource to help them prepare for their upcoming exams. I just wanted to say, as always, thank you so much for listening today. It's been wonderful to have your company for this episode, and I look forward to seeing you back here soon.
Wasn't that wonderful? If you're feeling inspired, why not leave us a rating and a review in your podcast app? It would make our day. Thanks again for listening, and see you soon.